Well, as we return to our series on Reformed spirituality, and as we pick up where we left off last week, it would be helpful, I think, for us to remember what we introduced last week, which will cover at least the next several lessons in this class. As last week, as you see on the board, we introduced a particular form of life that reflects what we said in our opening lecture, our opening class, captures the dynamism and the infrastructure, if you will, of biblical spirituality and its ethical and moral cast. And that is that it is the church's vocation by grace, understood along motherly lines, the virtue complex that belongs to motherliness in the Bible, being what the church's calling could be understood as including. And we noted that this is grounded in the way God reveals himself in his care for his people when he reveals himself along motherly lines, though he is only ever named as Father. The one named as Father relates in motherly ways, and this is a significant thing biblically, for how we understand the calling of the church in virtued and in ethical terms, especially since we see the Lord Jesus Christ himself adopting this very same mode of relating, the motherly mode of relating, as in Matthew's gospel, when he is motherly in relationship to the city of Jerusalem that he looks down on from the side of the hill and longs to pull the city under his motherly wings. And then the Apostle Paul himself, we noted, at times describes his form of relating to the churches as fatherly, and yet at other times describes it as motherly, not only his, but the apostles with him, as a motherly relationship, and also points us in Galatians to the church, the Jerusalem that is above, that is our mother, he calls her, as a motherly reality. So we talked at the very beginning of a motherly modality for the church's vocation and the Christian's vocation when understood in these relational and ethical and moral terms. And last week we suggested there is a form for that, and there is a dynamism for that. There is an active principle that helps the church look that way, live that way, and it is to adopt a Sabbatarian heart, mind, and rhythm of life, a way of looking at the world, a way of looking at ourselves, a way of being the church in this world along Sabbatarian lines. But we also noted that the notion of being a Sabbatarian itself needs to be carefully thought through. And it may prove to be the case that what we thought Sabbatarian meant upon examination of the scriptures may at least lack some things that the Bible seems to make quite important in that picture, and also might require that we reconfigure some things. We noted last week that one of the tragedies of Sabbatarianism as an idea, as a biblical principle, is the way that certain trajectories of the Christian tradition have eclipsed the positive facets of a Sabbatarian mentality and have eclipsed it by way of a very negative approach, defining Sabbatarianism by way of only negation, what one isn't, what one doesn't do, what is ruled out, without having a core commitment and understanding, verbally and practically, of what it's for, what it is about. Last time we suggested that in light of some helpful work done out there in biblical scholarship on the biblical theme and the function of it when it comes to the Sabbath, that when we connect it to the concerns of Christian spirituality, the Christian life, the ways and forms of the faithful church, we should understand this Sabbatarian heart, mind, and rhythm as a recognition of the Sabbath as both resistance and alternative. The Sabbath concept as both resistance and alternative. In other words, it is anything but a passive reality, but a very active thing. To be Sabbatarian involves the full agency of the individual. You're fully involved in this notion of Sabbatarian heart, mind, and rhythm. So let's begin our thinking along those lines, and more concretely, as we now pause over the critically important Exodus context for the Sabbath as a mode of life. One of the important things we need to have in place as we approach the Sabbath biblically is the fact that its context includes, though it is not exhausted by, includes social, but especially economic contexts and images that are rooted in Israel's experience in Egypt. That is figured in the face of Pharaoh, the persona of Pharaoh in particular, but is captured by Egypt in relationship to Egypt's gods. There is a concrete setting that involves this particular Pharaoh, the particular social and economic realities of ancient Egypt that are informing why the Sabbath is what it is and why God reveals himself the way that he does. Now, having said that, we immediately need to offer a word of clarification as well as even gentle warning. In the 1960s and into the 1970s, there was a very popular trend that survives, to be sure, in mainline liberal theology. But there was a very popular and influential trend that looked, in biblical studies and theology, and especially in church life, that looked at passages like Exodus and noted the important element of liberation from oppression. Liberation from abusive power, other forms of oppression, economic oppression, social oppression, and properly recognizing those important features of the biblical text and ethic, properly recognizing its importance in structuring and informing the way the Bible works and commends the good news of God's relationship to his people. Properly recognizing those things and recognizing as well that these are things that the church has very often missed or overlooked at least or unduly minimized and in preferring kind of more spiritualized metaphors for oppression and liberation and so forth. Overreacting to that weakness, overreacting to how it's been minimized, overreacting to how it's been eclipsed, these movements in the 60s and 70s reduced the biblical gospel to economic liberation, to social liberation, and it was called liberation theology. And when that Marxist in the classic sense mentality about social and economic structures took hold, it began to take other forms rooted in what we would now call identity politics. And so that original liberation theology paradigm ended up having siblings and cousins like feminist theology, which specified the form of oppression as oppression of women specifically. Or it was black liberation theology, African-American liberation theology, which took the general oppression theme and now specified it into the experience of African Americans, and so on and so on. And so basically any group that has in one way or another experienced oppression now became the context for reading what the gospel really is, as it must involve their release from those oppressive structures. Now, was there any truth in this? Absolutely. Evangelicals, Orthodox theologians recognize there's a lot of truth in the core idea of the thing that, yes, women have indeed been oppressed. And there's no question the gospel says good news to those experiencing oppression. The same, especially in the African slave experience, the same in other contexts, historically and socially and economically. But that is not what the gospel is at heart, as though it is only some kind of social, liberal, and political or economic program. The problem that the gospel addresses is not merely inequities or inequalities or maltreatment of this horizontal sort. And if that's not what the problem is most fundamentally, but those are expressions of a deeper problem, the solution should not be reduced to the church needs to be a group of really nice people who are active in their society and in their culture and feeding the poor and working to advance causes of justice and liberty and so on. And that is what the church is as such. Or the gospel is that God has come to break the bonds of every form of economic and social oppression so that everyone is equal and so on. No, that is a distortion of the gospel that works only because there is a seed of truth in it. And because of that seed of truth in it that has been blown out of proportion, it has come to eclipse what the gospel really is. Well, we don't want to overreact to that overreaction either by suggesting that these economic and cultural and political contexts in which God has revealed himself biblically and in which God is truly at work through the church graciously are somehow unimportant. But we need to have a due sense of proportion here. There is a center and there is a periphery. The peripheral matters are important because of their relationship to the central things. But when we reverse them, we distort the gospel, we lose what makes the good news, and we end up compromising the very identity of the church and the reason for Christ's coming. So we want to be alert to these vulnerabilities and these challenges, but again, not overreact to the point where we simply ignore, through over-spiritualization, what the Bible itself tells us rather strongly needs to be kept in view as contextual features for how God revealed himself. And this includes especially how he has revealed himself as a Sabbatarian God, which is what we're looking at today, is the relationship of the Sabbath to the first commandment. When God identifies himself the way he does in the prologue to the Decalogue and then gives us the first command regarding his worship. Now, in light of what I've just said, we can look at the Sabbath as resistance to a order of the world's thinking and doing, and an alternative to it along these lines. The Sabbath, we may understand, to be an alternative to the endless demands of economic reality. An alternative to the endless demands of economic reality. And more specifically, the demands of a market ideology that depends, as Adam Smith said long ago, that depends on the creation of and the generation of needs, the generation of desires that will leave us endlessly restless. That will leave us restless, that will leave us feeling inadequate, that will leave us feeling unfulfilled, and will leave us in pursuit of anything that may satiate, may fill, and satisfy that desire. So again, we're talking about a Sabbatarian mindset that has one's eyes wide open to how the Sabbath is an alternative to and resistance of a kind of economic reality, a market mindset, a market ideology that only works in the world around us, the world in which we live. It only works to the extent it is able to generate, to create desires within us that will never be satisfied fully. It is able to continue, able to exert its power, able to gain in momentum, in absorbing us and consuming us, only as it persuades us we need something. And so it advertises those needs to us. It impresses those alleged needs upon us. It communicates that unless we have these things or are these ways, we are not whole. And because we desire to be whole and to belong, we crave, we scratch, and we claw. This is the ideology that depends on generating these needs in order that we will be endlessly restless. As long as we will be restless, we will be buying. We will be accumulating. We will be grasping at what is being offered, which makes the ideology possible in its continuance. We are funding, as it were, that way of life and thought by participating in that way of life and thought, and the relationship is necessary for the ideology to work. They create a market, and then having created it, they create a market they can never fill, never fulfill. These requirements of this mentality and this life, this restlessness created by generated needs, these requirements concern endless predation, so that we become a society of 24/7 multitasking. In order to achieve enough, in order to accomplish enough, in order to perform and ultimately to possess what we have been told we absolutely need to be or to do or to have in order to be full. But the demands of that market ideology pertain as much to consumption as they do to production. We're not only talking about a demand that we suffer under, that we must produce more, but also the demand that we must consume more. So the system of commodity, where everything around us and everything about us is commodified, has a certain sticker price value, whether it's a value in dollars with respect to time spent, a value in dollars in terms of output, a value in dollars in terms of consumption. It is commodified in every respect. This system of commodity requires that we want more, requires that we have more, that we own more, that we use more, that we eat and drink more, that we become more. It is a rat race of predation and usurpation. That is a restlessness that issues inescapably in anxieties that are often at the edge of being unmanageable. When you pursue them vigorously enough, in fact, we find ourselves propelled to violence against the neighbor in eagerness for what properly belongs to that neighbor. And before we think, well, that's never me, because we think of violence as picking up the club in the hand and bopping our neighbor over the head with it, or pulling out the gun or the knife or something, think maybe primarily of non-physical forms of nevertheless real violence, a grasping at what is properly another's. Violence verbally, slander in order to build ourselves up, talking down about others, reducing them in the eyes of others to elevate ourselves. As dangerous and as severe as this is for society as a whole, what we learn when we consider biblical Sabbatarianism in a biblical context is that it's anything but new. And we will ourselves become a more faithful Sabbatarian people, not by thinking through concrete specific lists of all the do's and don'ts, and especially the don'ts that belong to the first day of the week, but when we have a different sense of proportion about such things by making this core and central. It's as old, our question is, our challenge is, as old as Pharaoh's insatiable demand for production. What we'll discover is how, maybe surprisingly, the world I just described is not unique to 20th or 21st century America or the West. But it is as old as Exodus, and it's the very environment in which God gave a Sabbath command and said something important about himself along the way. It's impossible to imagine that in the system of Pharaoh, there could ever be restfulness for anyone, including himself. We'll see this in Exodus chapter 5 and verses 4 to 19 in a bit. Most remarkably, Israel, in the narrative of Exodus, when she is finally delivered from Pharaoh's anxiety system, which is how we should look at it, and comes to the wilderness. There in the wilderness, we discover that Israel is given bread. But bread that it is not permitted to store. Which explodes in importance when we begin to understand how the whole Pharaoh and Egypt system of slavery and oppression of the Israelites was a system of storage. How to store more. The need for more cities and settlements in which to store the allegedly or hopefully ideally endless production of the slave system. The production of the slave system is in excess of need, and then what's in excess of need needs to be stored. It is the marker for Egyptian wealth, but there are only so many places to put it, so the need to create more cities for storage is very much at the heart of the problem in Exodus for Israel. And Israel in the wilderness is called specifically to live differently and not to be preoccupied with storage. Why? Well, even more remarkably, perhaps, in that kind of vulnerable and marginal context, with a daily need for daily bread given only for the day, a provision is made for the Sabbath, that Israel cannot store up bread for more than a day, except, and a big except, on the sixth day. When Israel may store up enough for the seventh day so that it can rest on that day. Exodus 16 verses 13 to 24. Now that unexpected provision is undoubtedly a sign that this bread for life is not under the demanding governance of Pharaoh. It is under the sustaining rule of the Creator God. Even in the wilderness with scarce resources, God commands a pause for Sabbath for the community. In verses 25 to 30 of Exodus 16, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be no gathering. There will be nothing to gather. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, and they found none. The Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and instructions? Look, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you food for 2 days. Each of you stay where you are. Don't leave your place on the seventh day." And so the people rested on the seventh day. The conclusion the narrative is making for us is that wherever God governs as an alternative, here's alternative language, wherever God governs as an alternative to Pharaoh and his whole system, there the restfulness of Yahweh effectively and visibly counters the restless anxiety of the Egyptian world of Pharaoh. In fact, the bondage in Egypt is not then merely bondage to a taskmaster in a 9-to-5 or 9-to-9, whatever the case may be, work day. It's not that small or narrow sense of bondage. The whole system depended on bondage, and God is different. In our own context of the rat race of anxiety, the celebration of the Sabbath, or a Sabbath way of thinking and living, is therefore both resistance and alternative. Resistance, because it's a visible insistence that our lives are not defined by the production and consumption of commodity goods. Our lives are not defined by the expectations and the demands of a marketing, advertising, celebrity culture. Our lives are not defined by the 24/7 work-a-day, work-a-night reality of an international world of commerce. Now that kind of act of resistance requires enormous deliberateness, intentionality, but it also requires communal reinforcement. What's quite interesting is that there's no such thing biblically as an individualistic Sabbath mindset or life. It's as though it's treated not only as an unintelligible concept, it makes no sense if you define it, but it's also assumed to be impossible. To be Sabbatarian is not not a possibility for someone on their own, because it's not simply a matter of not doing things. It is a communal reality, which is part of why the Bible has these repeated and unflinching expectations of the regularity of assembled Christians. In order to resist like this, we need resources beyond what we have in our own hearts. We need resources beyond what we have in our own stamina, our own repeated promises and pledges and renewed commitments. We are not able to do it. And never were we expected, though, to be able to do it. To be able to resist like this requires great deliberateness, intentionality, but also communal realities, communal reinforcement against the barrage of seductive pressures from the insatiable instances of the market, with its intrusion into every part of our lives, from the family dinner table to the national budget and national politics, and getting clothes for the children at the shop, and deciding what amenities to purchase and which ones not to purchase when decorating our rooms, or providing for our children's education, or buying this or buying that, making this car decision or that one. The questions intrude into every part of us. Like the sand when you leave the beach, it just takes you days to get every bit of it out of you. It finds its way into places you never thought it could go, ever thought it could reach. And this is exactly the image for how it is surrounding us. And Exodus demands of God's covenant people that we read our situation faithfully, because none of this will make sense unless we are prepared at the outset to call things false gods that may not look like the gods of wood and of stone that the Egyptian gods looked like. Why? Because those Egyptian gods were only figures for an entire order of life and of thought. And anything that focuses and belongs to that order of life and thought, the people of God are being called to name properly. Call it what it is. And as you call it what it is, know that you don't have what you need inside yourself as an individual to meet the challenge where it is. But the church, as the church, is a people called to this and equipped for it. In our anxious society, to use a case in point, one of the great seductions of Pharaoh is the fact that so very easily, whether it's sports practices, whether it is family events that are purely family events, whether it is business demands spilling over from the work week, that there are intrusions from this world order and life and thought into the Lord's day that more and more regularly displace the urgency of this communal reinforcement of public worship. As a church as a whole, that is, the church in every space and place on earth, we continue to wrestle with the central thing being the central thing so that everything else is in its proper place. And so when, to use this example of sports practices or whatever the case may be, when it presents itself as laying a claim to us on the day when God makes his claim most visible concerning us, the church is to recognize that while this may be sports on Monday through Saturday, when it presents itself as the alternative to who we really are on the Lord's Day, it is not to be named as sports, but to be named as a God. Anything that would compete with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, anything that would displace the communal reinforcement on the day of our rest, is not just a thing. But if we adopt the Sabbatarian way of life and faith, orientation to the world, everything, no matter what it might be, which would set us apart and out of that communal context by substituting for it, is a God. This is simply to read ourselves and our experiences the way Exodus demands that Israel understand the why of the Sabbath. On the Sabbath, the church is reminded that it is not in a neutral world, but that Monday through Saturday, she is called to faithfulness in a context of constant threats and challenges. On the Lord's Day, the war is made visible, and the church is called to do what the world cannot do. Stop. And rest. Families, largely contained within this market ideology, think of themselves as helpless before the requirements and demands of the commitments of the world belonging to that ideology. In context, such a resistance, such a intentionality, such a deliberateness, a faithfulness along these lines would require enormous communal resolve to resist the demands by calling them what they are at the start. But Sabbath isn't only resistance. Again, this is where a lot of the problems happen. It is not doing these things. It is not going doing those things in place of public worship. It is also alternative. It's an alternative to the demanding, chattering, pervasive presence of advertising, the great liturgical claim, which is what it is, of professional sports that would devour all of our rest time and leave us nothing for time with God's people. I use the sports one because it's the most visible one in our culture, in the American West especially. In other parts of the world, it looks differently. It is a different kind of thing, a different kind of challenge. In every case, the problem isn't sports. The problem isn't the thing itself. The problem is the claim it makes over us in the one space we are God's worshipers. It is the whisper to worship another, precisely because it is a substitute for worship of God. The alternative on offer in the good news of a rest, Sabbath rest, is the awareness and the practice of the claim that we are situated on the receiving end of the gifts of God. To be situated in the place where God gives his gifts, to be located there, is a staggering option in the world in which we live. Because we are used to being on the initiating end of things. Again, we are expected to be producing, to be becoming, to be beautifying, to be consuming, giving, releasing. We don't even expect, and sometimes therefore seldom even want, a gift to be truly and simply given. So accustomed have we become to accomplishing, to achieving, to possessing, to deserving. We're so accustomed to the way of life that requires we labor to receive, that we deserve in order to gain, that we are most uncomfortable with the very concept of receiving without deserving, to the point where we become ironically ashamed of being in such a place. Which is why we need to come to think of this fourth commandment and then the Lord's Day reality later on as maybe the most difficult and most urgent of the commandments in the world in which we live, the lives which we live, precisely because it calls us to intention, to deliberateness, to conduct that defies the most elemental requirements of a commodity-propelled society that specializes in control, in entertainment, in shame, that only works if we feel awful about ourselves, that only works if we feel awful about ourselves. We are living in the world which Pascal seemed to have anticipated when he wrote that it is maybe the most difficult thing for the human being to do, to be alone in a room. That is our world now. To be alone, not doing something, producing something, to be alone and to survive it without the sense of worthlessness, without the despair, without the shame and the despondency that now ordinarily accompanies us in times we are alone long enough for it. This is a way of thinking and a way of life that defies what the world around us demands. And the ways of violence that are usually assumed in order to satiate it. And so our series and our reflections in these few lessons is addressed exactly to those who are weary and heavy laden, and made weary, made heavy laden by the insatiable requirements of our society and our sinful inclination to live on its terms. The world's taxation for the sake of power. Social conformity, urging us to do and to have more. The frightening intention that there should never be any such thing as a free lunch for anyone. And its assumption that there is a technological resolution for every human problem, and the pathologies of greed and control. Now, in a world like that, what would it be like to notice what's really going on in the public worship of God's people, where the bread of the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist as it's classically called, is given as a gift? Some have thought that for this very reason, the Eucharist is the quintessential center of the very idea of the Sabbath, the idea of the rest in Christian tradition. It is gift, and we receive it in gratitude. Imagine having a sacrament called thanks, which is what Eucharist means. We are on the receiving end. And that table reminds us who we are at bottom. We are not a deserving people, nor should we try to be, on the world's terms, that is. We are not called to produce what is on offer there. We are not called to generate it. We are called to be quiet and grateful for something received as a gift. And yet what happens? When we buy into the ways of thought and life in the world, which works only to the extent it makes us ashamed and anxious, it also ends up keeping us from the gift. I don't want to come to the Lord's table because I'm not sure I am enough yet. I'm not sure I have enough yet. When if there is the humility to recognize that, there is the humility in repentance, which is the call of the church as a whole, to recognize that we have the one necessity, the one prerequisite. And that is to recognize that what I am given as gift. That moment of gift is a peaceable, not violent, alternative that many who are weary and heavy laden, who are cumbered with a load of care, as the hymn says, can receive gladly. The offer of free gift. It might just help us to understand that we can stop the dramatic anti-neighborliness to which our society, our world, is madly, uncritically committed. Along these lines, we notice that the fourth commandment on the Sabbath is a crucial bridge that connects the Ten Commandments together. The fourth commandment looks back to the first three commandments and the God who says he rests, Exodus 20, verses 3 to 7. At the same time, the Sabbath commandment looks forward to the last six commandments that concern the neighbor, verses 12 to 17. They provide for rest alongside the neighbor. God, self, all members of the household share in a common rest on this day. It's a social reality, therefore, that provides a commonality. We have this in common. Provides a coherence, something that ties us together, not only within the community of the covenant, strictly speaking, but as human beings called to stop, to rest. The first commandment, therefore, concerns God, concerns his character, concerns his name, Exodus 20, verses 3 to 7. And we notice that in these verses, God is not known apart from the story he belongs to. He will not reveal himself outside of who he is in what he has done. So let's look at these verses together. If you have your Bible, Exodus chapter 20, and I'll read verses 3 to 7, and ask you to notice the importance of God's story in the way the commandment is given as its reason. You will have no other gods before me. I'm sorry, verse 2. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You will have no other gods before me. You will not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You will not bow down to them or serve them, because I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You will not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Starting in verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you will labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant, your female servant or your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. Because in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Starting in verse 2, it is not just the God who is out there, but the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. In other words, the Sabbath command is pulled into the Exodus story because the God who rests, as the reason for the fourth command, the God who rests is the God who emancipates, who liberates from slavery and therefore from the working system and order of Egypt and Egypt's gods, who require and legitimate that system within which Israel knew slavery. For this reason, it's fair to conclude the prohibition against the other gods in the first commandments pertain directly to the gods of Egypt, as in Exodus 12:12, and other gods of the same ilk in Canaan, or the later gods of Assyria, Babylon, and Persia. Within the imagination of Israel, which is storied, the gods of Egypt are stand-ins for the gods of the several empires, and what they all have in common is that they are confiscatory gods. They demand endless produce. They authorize endless systems of production that are in principle insatiable. Just to mention Egypt is to bring the God of Israel into the orbit of that whole system and to say he is not like that. In the case of the Egyptian gods, who are set opposite the God of the Exodus. Pharaoh is the one who provides the system of production and mandates it as it is legitimated by the gods Pharaoh worships. And in Exodus 5, we're given a passionate narrative account of that labor system, where Pharaoh endlessly demands more production. The slaves are to produce more bricks to use to build more supply cities in which Pharaoh can store his endless supply of material wealth in the form of grain, Exodus 1:11. The system is designed to produce more and more surplus. There's always more need for storage units, and so there's more need for bricks in order to construct those storage units. So if we begin with the bricks and follow them all the way through to their headwaters, it is the gods of Pharaoh who are behind the wide-ranging reality captured by the little word slavery in Egypt. Pharaoh, yes, is the hard-nosed production manager for whom production schedules are inexhaustible, but he's only a pawn of the gods of Pharaoh. And against that, we have the God of Israel, who invites his people to stop and check out of that whole system and rest, because he himself is a God of rest.